minimum wage. Yeah, it is troubling. And we focused on how Amazon presented price gouging. Amazon came out very early saying that it was unacceptable to them. Bezos himself identified this issue in his shareholders letter in April. And so our primary concern was, are they doing anything? And we would argue they're not. It has been a marketing campaign, in our view, not an actual effort to stop this process. And they would argue that there's millions of products and it's a whack-a-mole type process to try to stop this. Well, you can right now go to Amazon.com and start searching for essential products and find price gouging. This is not a whack-a-mole. This is a pervasive problem. And they are doing nothing. And so the only conclusion we can draw is they either don't care or there is a profit motivation here. And it is important to note, we were focused on Amazon as the seller, but they have arguably a greater profit motivation when it is a third-party seller engaging in this. And so the fact that third-party sellers are continuing and Amazon themselves are doing this suggests that they do not see this as a problem because they are looking to maximize profit during the pandemic.
Alex Harmon, we want to thank you for being with us with Public Citizen, author of the new report, Prime Gouging, How Amazon Raised Prices to Profit from the Pandemic. And that does it for our show. We'll link to that at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us. Wear a mask.
Stay safe.
You are
listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a program director to manage our programming department. This full-time position requires proven experience in program directing, radio audio production, management, and supervisory skills with volunteers, with an emphasis on teamwork and a collaborative setting, and the ability to work under strict deadlines. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. The deadline to apply for this position is Saturday, October 3rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm/employment.
It is KBOO Portland. It is 8 o'clock. It is Tuesday. It is time for what we're still calling the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program with your hosts, Abe Proctor and Tracy Simmons. Stay tuned.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone, as you're tucked tight beneath your blanket of smoke on this hazy Tuesday morning. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM. Welcome to the show. We are joined once again this week by Tracy Simmons. Tracy, good morning.
Good morning, Abe. Good morning, listeners.
We have, as usual, an abundance of things to talk about. This is like a buffet table for talk show hosts these days, I got to tell you. A little of this, a little of that, or you can just wait till you're at the end and just have a plate full of bacon. It's just kind of one of those news periods right now. Yes, and I just did compare our fraying republic to a breakfast buffet, but that's okay. We want to talk this morning broadly about how, even in the midst of all of these overlapping crises that are now besetting our society, that the so-called culture wars, for lack of a better term, seem to be broadening, worsening, deepening. The rift between the opposite poles of so many Americans seems to only be exacerbated these days. And as we're going to show, this has some real-world consequences that impact the health and well-being and safety of many, many people. So I mentioned the smoke. Obviously, unless you've been sleeping in your basement and haven't come outside for weeks, in fact, that's probably a pretty good personal health choice, sitting in your basement for weeks. The entire West Coast is ablaze. This is beyond a shadow of a doubt, the product of climate change. And part of today's program is going to be addressing that aspect of the culture wars that continues to divide Americans. More specifically, and I want to use this as an endpoint for the conversation today, a video was posted on YouTube a few days ago depicting a Clackamas County Sheriff's deputy in conversation with private citizens about the fires that had been ravaging so much of that county. And on camera, the deputy mentions that there are Antifa, and he uses a rather colorful adjective to describe these Antifa members, are running around looting and setting fires in the countryside. He encourages his fellow citizens to follow and help identify these phantom Antifa arsonists and looters. And he goes on in this conversation, he and the public citizens that he's talking about, private citizens, they go on to talk about the fact that, well, if Antifa is coming out here into the countryside and setting fires and looting houses, well, the next time there's a demonstration downtown, well, we're going to show up there and bust them head. So this is the cultural divide, fracturing us even as our world is burning down around us. We cannot even collaborate, it seems, for the purpose of our mutual safety. We can't do it without falling out on either side of this divide. And even, as we have seen repeatedly, conjuring up these spectral antagonists that aren't actually there and aren't actually doing the things they're being accused of doing. And what's more, after making that conjuration, transferring that anger toward the next time they have an opportunity to rumble with Black Lives Matter demonstrators or with Antifa demonstrators. This is truly, Tracy, a surreal moment in our history.
I mean, I'm getting to that point of overwhelm where it's just so ridiculous that we are infighting while everything around us is ablaze, right? From what I know in Portland, Antifa demonstrators and people who had been a part of the protest most recently were bringing water to their neighbors, checking on elder people, you know, like doing benevolence. I follow on Twitter one of kind of a local reporter, Sergio Olmos, who showed up in Clackamas and was, you know, one of the people that were confronted. Are you Antifa? You shouldn't be here. And literally was there to tell the story and share the story of what was happening in Malino, Malala area in Clackamas County. And so, you know, you have to like step back and say, okay, who is this division serving? And why do we continue falling into these patterns? I did see a photo of a person who was is allegedly the person setting fires in one of the fires in Southern Oregon, and he absolutely did not look like Antifa to me. Of course, I don't know his political leanings. I don't know that, you know, or why someone would want to create arson in this way and harm so many people. But we have to start really questioning the motivations of people who want to keep this division going. Is it about a culture war? Is it about you know, being so harmed that you want other people to feel that same kind of pain? But eventually we're going to have to get to a point where we begin to heal ourselves, because right now the leadership of our country and of our local communities, and I would see a police deputy as a leader of some sort in the community, are not really here to help us heal. So like at this point, I'm kind of like, what do we do to bring us together and help us heal? If a crisis of you know, no one's specific making, right, in the climate fires is what's driving the current harm, as I speak, you know, my air quality is at 415, and I can't go outside, what will do it? What will bring us together? Or is it just time for us to just, you know, give up half of Oregon to Idaho and call it good? I really don't know what the answer is, and I'm hoping we'll have some amazing callers who can chime in with their perspectives today, because I'm never at a loss for words, but I'm really getting to that point where the overwhelm is so much I don't even know what to say anymore.
I know what you mean. The disconnect just is so jaw-dropping. It's hard to even address it. Like, you know, at a time when the countryside is burning down, citizens are setting up checkpoints at roadways and screening vehicles to see if any Antifa are inside, and that seems counterproductive at the very least, you know, and dangerous at worst. You're right, it absolutely boggles the mind. You're also right that our leadership right now doesn't inspire healing energy. Donald Trump's certainly not a balm for anyone's frayed nerves, I don't think. Here's another example of what we're talking about. This is a tweet from the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, posted on Friday. Deputies have contacted several groups of residents in Corbett who have set up checkpoints and are stopping cars. While we understand their intent is to keep the community safe, it is never legal to block a public roadway or force other citizens to stop. This, I think, is a casualty of the disinformation system, Tracy, that you and I have talked about a few times over the last couple of weeks. This completely and fully formed informational ecosystem in which people who occupy the rightmost part of the political spectrum can find their own set of facts to describe the universe. And that set of facts demonstrably does not match up with the measurable universe. And now we're seeing the fallout from that. Now we are seeing citizens ratting one another out, citizens trying to expose one another as colluding with the enemy, even as the landscape burns around them. It's disappointing, it's depressing, it's frustrating, and as you mentioned, where do we turn for healing? I don't have a ready answer for that.
Yeah. I mean, even the idea that we're, you know, in some ways through mechanisms like Facebook and other avenues which are absolutely proliferating the disinformation, that we don't have a check on that. And the people who make money off of Facebook continue to, you know, really thwart any efforts to check that disinformation campaign that is a steady stream, whether it's, you know, the most recent reports about people calling the human trafficking lines because they heard about QAnon and pedophiles and all of this other stuff. Or now we have people literally willing to confront their neighbors, most likely, because I'm not traveling to Corbett. I don't know who they're looking for, how they're going to know someone that, you know, doesn't need to be passing through, right? I'm guessing they're going to be checking for people based on phenotypes and what they look like, which is terrible in and of itself. And so we have to just begin to think, like, how do we reverse this? Because I think this information that's coming out that is really polarizing in so many ways has such a reach anymore, and it's moving lightning fast, right? The way that this information is being distributed, that people are glomming onto it, and it's causing, in this case, vigilantism that, you know, will result in more violence. We know if someone is confronted and told to get out of their car, like, depending on who that is, it's probably not going to go very well. And so we really have to begin thinking and strategizing around how to stop the disinformation, whether it's, you know, with our dollars, our money that we spend, making sure that we are not supporting organizations that continue and proliferate disinformation, whether that's stop watching fake news, whether that's disconnecting from your Facebook. We've got to do it with our dollars, and there has to be some level of organization and strategy around that, because this is, to me, and I say this all the time, our revolution is going to depend on critical consumer of information. It's going to depend on data literacy. It's going to depend on being able to discern what's true and what's not. And if we can't do those basic things, we're going to be stuck, right? And actually, it's going to be really nasty if this continues into the future. And so we have to become able to strategize and collectively engage in ways to stop the disinformation. We have a president that thrives on disinformation as well, whether, you know, you've heard the reports about him telling folks to vote twice, vote in person and cast their, absentee ballots, depending on where you are. This person's telling people that, you know, there's organized people coming to stop the election or violently demonstrate after the election, and that you need to be prepared for that. This person right now, who's in the highest leadership of the land, is also fomenting disinformation. And so what do we do about that? We have to do something about that as well.
I agree, and I don't know that the answer lies solely in countering disinformation or factual information, although that is a necessary component of pushback, I think. I think what we really need to do is something you're getting at in your comments just now, is instill in people the apparatus to be literate in terms of interpreting the media and making sense of it. However, that's something that takes practice and dedication and time. And time is something that's in very, very short supply right now. So, I mean, I don't know if we have, if there's enough time in between now and the election, you know, to give people the tools they need to make sense of the information coming at them. It feels like that's something we should have addressed collectively a long time ago. So between now and Election Day, I don't know. I don't know what we do to push back on this. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. I'm very, very interested to hear what our listeners have to say about the goings-on today, or the discussion we're having today and the goings-on that we're experiencing each and every day here. There is an aspect of the interaction with that Clackamas County Sheriff's deputy that I think bears a little further examination from us, and that is this. This was a uniformed, badge-carrying member of law enforcement. On the clock, you can see him in his uniform standing in front of his car on this video clip, talking with citizens about how they're going to crack down on another segment of the citizenry that the officer explicitly identifies not only as Antifa, but as left-wing. This level of collusion between conservative elements in private citizenry and in law enforcement, there's a word for it, and it's fascism. That is fascism. Talking freely about going into downtown and exacting revenge upon Black Lives Matter demonstrators for phantom crimes committed in the countryside by spectral Antifa arsonists. This is deeply troubling, and I think it gives lie to the argument that says, well, most cops are good cops, right? 99.9% of cops are good cops. It's just a few bad apples that keep acting violently and keep taking out their racist tendencies upon people of color. But I think we have a growing body of evidence that suggests that this problem goes far beyond 0.1%. It's a cultural thing. There's enough of a critical mass there that it persists, that it's part of law enforcement culture, and that it overlaps with and sympathizes with similar thinking elements among private citizens. So we have this sort of ideologically oriented block that that overlaps conservative private citizens, conservative members of law enforcement, and most unfortunately, the beliefs and the acts and the words of the most powerful elected representative in the United States. All of this adds up to a situation that is incredibly dangerous. And I know there's a tendency whenever we start talking about sort of thing, we start raising the specter of a possible fascist takeover in this country. I'm here to tell you right now that this is not some abstraction that I'm placing off into the future. If you look at scholarship depicting the various stages of the onset of fascism, we are not at the beginning looking at what might be. We are several steps along this scale already, and the conditions have never been more ripe for this element in our society to rise to the ascendancy. I want to remind people that in the last free election held in Weimar, Germany, before the National Socialists, before the Nazis took over, the Nazis managed to garner about 40% of the vote. In other words, about the same proportion of the electorate that is ride or die for Donald Trump in this country. And after that 40% became ensconced in power, it only took the exploitation of a few crises before the fascists were able to take over completely. And it's also notable that the largest of those crises, the Reichstag fire, was an artificial crisis manufactured so that it could be exploited by the fascists seeking to take power. This is the precipice at which we stand in this country. And if we can't mobilize around that fact, if we are continued to be riven apart by natural disasters that are somehow reinforcing this cultural divide, the next few months they make me scared, Tracy.
Absolutely. And I think everyone should be worried. And I'm not a person that's a fear monger. I feel like that is how we've gotten here, through you know, media that really preys upon people's fear. And I said it in the back, that when people are in a place of panic and fear, the logical mind does not prevail, right? And so there's that. And I don't want to fear monger, but it is pretty scary to me personally, because I understand the historical underpinnings of fascism and the rise of fascism and what I see currently. And I think what's challenging is that we can say things like Antifa, we can, you know, call people who are anti-fascist different names, but I don't know that fascism is well-defined for most people who are not academics, who are not scholars of history, who have not, you know, really looked at other cultures and how fascism has taken hold in historical texts and historical context. And so really when we start talking about fascism as a political concept, we have to know what that means, right? And so there's that nationalism that undergirds everything, that, you know, you and your country are the only thing that matter and other people don't really count. There is a clear and you know, considerable disdain for human rights. We've seen that at the border crisis. We've seen that show up in multiple different ways, that human rights are not central to, you know, the true democracy that we would like to see in our country. There's an identification of enemies as a unifying cause, whether that's Antifa, whether that's Black Lives Matter, whether that's immigrants, whether that's poor people, you know, you name it. There's a whole bunch of them right now that have been identified as enemies of the state. There's a you know, deep and underlying supremacy of military and militarism. We've seen that. Rampant sexism, control of the mass media. We see that happening today. An obsession with national security, although there is incompetence within that arena. Religion and government intertwined. I don't know if you saw the Republican National Committee convention, but every moment anybody could sneak in and God bless America and God and God and God, it was done. There is the corporate power that's being protected, and we've seen that in the skinny bill that came out for Mitch McConnell and the Republicans around restarting the economy. There was a sole focus on protecting corporate interests by saying we're going to make sure that if anybody gets sick from COVID, that the corporations are protected, right? And so we've seen this happen in multiple ways. Of course, you know, we're suppressing the power of labor unions. There's disdain for intellectuals and the arts, absolutely. Right now there is an anti-intellectualism fervor that is harming higher education, harming K-12 education, public education specifically. There's an obsession with crime and punishment. There's rampant corruption and the potential for fraudulent elections, right? So taken as a package, and to your point, Abe, we are far along that trajectory, but I don't think we've done a really good job of framing for average, everyday Americans what fascism is and what anti-fascism is, because we're in this weird space where we're naming things different things so we can create more enemies. And so I think there has to be a learning curve that we get our regular citizens on to understand and see these signs.
Wow. Wow. I think you're right. Why don't we go to the phones, see what our listeners have to say. Joe, you're first up this morning. What's on your mind?
Thank you. You're painting a very dark picture today, which I have been witnessing for quite some time. I called 6 months ago and made the comment that I believe our country is ripe for coming apart. And last week you had a caller who said that could splitting up be done in a fashion that would be agreeable to all sides or to many sides. In the past, I've seen that we have such strong differences, even in Oregon right now, between rural and the more progressive parts of the state. And if you go throughout the country, recognize that I term it as regions that are the New England area, we have the South, we have the Midwest, Texas is always a separate entity, we have the West between the Rockies and Eastern, and including Eastern Oregon, that area, and then we have the West Coast. I think liberal environments, which are, to me, the biggest economic engine, must be getting tired of going such a conservative route where we don't deal with climate change, we're not dealing with science, and that our regional differences allow us to incorporate what is best for the region. And if we could do more promotion on, look, 330 million people in our country, we're just not going to be able to manage that anymore. We have too many self-interest. And so if we were to start promoting, let's look at this as breaking up the country. We still have strong regional areas that would be able to protect themselves, and the idea of coming together would be much easier if we recognize that we're just too many people to manage on this type of scale right now.
Wow, provocative comments. Thank you very much for the call. Well, there's a lot in there. Yes, the regional differences in the country, I think, are becoming more and more stark. But the broader point that Joe made about blue states essentially propping up and feeding their tax dollars to red states is absolutely true. The built-in political imbalances in our system give the weights of votes for senators from Wyoming, for example, far more weight than a senator from California would wield in the Congress. And as a result, we have in blue states, where our outlook is far more progressive, have to deal with the flotsam and jetsam associated with the wishes of governing officials in red states. And to summarize, you could say that blue states have to put up with the pollution that red states are demanding. And that's absolutely true. And so the argument for a secession of the more populous, more educated, more wealthy, more progressive parts of the country from the rest, that's a pretty compelling argument, I think. All right, let's go. Oh, did you have something to say, Tracy?
No, I'm going to hold my comments.
Okay, let's go to Marcos. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm concerned that there's going to be another dust-up between the Proud Boys, Patriot Prayer, and progressives in Portland on the 26th coming up. So that's been announced. I think that's very regrettable. I think it's a historical mistake by progressives to be confronting the so-called right. There was a quote not too long ago from Joey Gibson, the founder of Patriot Prayer, that Antifa made me, that we would have just been a bunch of guys with flags hanging on a street corner if we didn't get this pushback from Antifa. I'm paraphrasing. But I thought he was being very candid, and I wish people would pick up on the clue that Joey Gibson would be best ignored. There's an argument within the so-called anti-fascist forces that if you ignore them, they'll just metastasize and grow and spread, and that it's a mistake to minimize their importance. I think the opposite is true. I think Joey Gibson and Proud Boys get all their oxygen from conflict with the left. And to be stepping into their trap, to be choosing to engage with those kind of clowns on a stage of their choosing, is a historic mistake. And I think the idea of even calling Antifa Antifa was a historic mistake. People are constantly trying to explain what Antifa means, and they say, we're anti-fascist. Well, why not just say anti-fascist? By using this quasi-Euro term, Antifa, or maybe it is a European term, it just exoticizes and creates a bit of a mystery around something that should be very straightforward. Okay, you're anti-fascist. There it is. The anonymity of dressing up in black is also, in a way, a propaganda gift to the right, that you've now created this mystery which can be explained in any sort of way by the opposition. As who are these people that are masked, and they have this exotic name, and they represent essentially the boogeyman? You can fill in the blank. One last question is, you had announced a couple of weeks ago that Joe was leaving the show, but never explained why. I'll take my answer off the air.
Hey, thank you for the call. Well, let me address that last point first. Yes, Joe is no longer with the show, and I feel that it is not my place to offer an explanation about that. If and when Joe decides to make a statement, he can do so, but I am going to decline to comment about that. To the other points you made, about a year and a half ago, we had on the program two representatives from Rose City Antifa, and we talked about this phenomenon, like why is it necessary to show up and confront groups like the Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer when they come to town? Why not just ignore them and, as their caller suggested, let the air out of their balloon? The answer we got was that when that happens, groups like Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys will seek out victims. And by that I mean there's a few times when Antifa and other progressive folks didn't show up to confront these guys when they came to town, and they ended up attacking and vandalizing the homes of prominent anti-fascists in the community. They went after union halls, and they look to damage property and injure human bodies when they come to town. So the defense offered by the representatives of Rose City Antifa was that we must come out and meet them when they come to our town so that they do not victimize people in the community. So I think that's part of the answer. The second part of the answer is, for me, speaking just for me, is a little less rational, a little more visceral, and that is that these people are the worst among us. And I do not want them coming to my town, carrying their weapons through the streets of my town, thumping their chests, spreading their noxious fascist ideology, not in my town. And I think that spirit is what's animating much of the resistance from the Antifa side of things as well. Do you have anything to add to that, Tracy?
I mean, I just the caller hit on a lot of really good points, and you know, I agree to some extent that if people are showing up in the streets with guns, if you don't engage them, they'll go away. Unfortunately, what we've seen is that that's not true in this case, that these people are not going away, and they are being engaged. So maybe there needs to be a different strategy. I agree that we could reconsider strategy. I say we, not me necessarily, but I don't necessarily want people parading through my town either. And the optics of that, as you know, is this something that's Portland, or is this something from somewhere else? I don't really know. But if you're going to get a fight and you're looking for a fight, and we give you a fight, we've given you what you wanted. I also feel like, you know, and you know, we've had conversations about defunding the police and other things, but we know that the Patriot Prayer and other right-wing groups have a different level of protection for themselves because of fascism, right? So there is a collusion with law enforcement that makes it not safe for other people to be in the presence of the Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer and other right-wing groups, because they are protected, and they have infiltrated many of our policing systems and organizations in the Portland metro area and in the larger region, which is problematic, as we noted with the comments of the sheriff deputy from Clackamas County. There is a larger construct here that we have to get at and become aware of. And when these clashes happen, I've seen similar situations in different towns where the two groups are separated completely. They cannot engage, they cannot fight, they cannot touch mm-hmm. each other. They can stand across the street from one another and wave and yell, and that's it, and then it goes away. I think what has happened in Portland is Portland has done a very, very poor job of managing these clashes, with air quotes, because they shouldn't be clashes. There should be no ability for each side to really do anything but demonstrate. We allow them to engage in violence in our streets, and then we say, well, Antifa, they shouldn't have shown up. Well, nobody should have shown up, because everyone came looking for a fight. And at this point, I have to go back to my earlier comments of, how do we heal ourselves? What is that red meat we are all looking for? And how do we check ourselves on that? Why are we looking for a fight? Why aren't we looking to understand each other, you know, deepen that understanding and become more aware of how this division is not serving any of us, whether we talk about blue states and red states. I don't know why an abortion for a person in Oregon matters at all to a person in Alabama. So when we talk about these hot button issues, they oftentimes are not about what's serving these rural communities. They're about controlling people. And on some level, we have to also recognize who that's serving, right? Many of the large issues, whether it's climate change, right? And right now we know that the rural communities are being impacted even more so than urban communities when we talk about wildfires, because I don't live in the woods. I'll just say that. I live in the city, and although my air quality is quite terrible, I have not had to evacuate from my house, and I have nothing right. but the utmost empathy and compassion for people who have had to leave their homes and lose their homes potentially. And the policies of denial of climate change, the policies of denial of the challenges with billionaires and capitalism, the challenges of protecting the sanctity of life for some people, when 200,000 Americans have died, is just complete and utter nonsense. That's not what we're here to fight about. Someone has us fighting about things that have no relation to our regular everyday lives, and have created this division and control us through that division. When do we wake up to that?
Wow, I think that is so absolutely true. And I think there's a couple other wrinkles here that are worth mentioning, and that is that among those people who choose to think of themselves as Antifa or choose to position themselves in opposition to what they see as incipient fascism, I would venture that one of the reasons that they feel compelled to come out and confront the Patriot Boys or the Patriot Prayer and the CIA conflated them. That works really well. Patriot Prayer and Proud Boys is because, as we discussed earlier, they have looked at the historical antecedents of fascist movements around the world, and they realize quite well that we are several steps down that slippery slope already to a fascist takeover. And they are justifiably alarmed at that and feel compelled to resist fascists when they march openly on the streets of our town. And I can't really fault that motivation. And the last thing I want to say on this, well, we all know it won't be the last, but right now, is that I think the spectrum of people who identify as anti-fascists, even if they don't say, I am Antifa, has broadened dramatically, especially in recent months. And especially, I think, here in Portland, galvanized by the events that we see playing out every night on our streets. When you think back to when the confrontations with Trump's federal goons were at their height, and we saw things like the wall of moms sweeping through downtown Portland, that group of people is absolutely, without a doubt, unequivocally anti-fascist, even if they don't call themselves Antifa. So I think that the groups of people we identify as Antifa that we conceive of as wearing black and masking their faces and being willing to engage in violent conflict with the Proud Boys and with Patriot Prayer, that is just the tip of a much larger sociological iceberg, if you will. There's a lot more people who now consider themselves to be opponents of fascism and now who understand where we are along that continuum and are willing to make their views known by putting their bodies in the streets. That's a phase change in the body politic. And that's something we can't ignore when we're assessing what's going on right now either. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Joe. Good morning.
Sorry, Camilo's up first, then Joe.
Sorry, Camilo. Camilo, you're first.
This is Camilo. That last discussion is really compelling, and I would like to engage in it, but I really have something else on my mind that's not really unrelated to the general discussion of this morning's talk. And I'm going to start with saying that I'm in a group that reads the New Yorker monthly, and we discuss articles. And this month, I'm going to discuss the entire June 22nd issue of the New Yorker, which was about Black Lives Matter. And the most compelling thing about looking at the entire issue is the fact that nothing really has changed. They have been writing reports about these race riots since the 18th century. There's something like 46 different reports. And essentially, they're written so that it appears the government is doing something when they actually don't do anything. And there's no indication that there's going to be any progress. And I think that things are actually continuing to deteriorate. There's no stopping the police from attacking Black people for no reason at all. But that's not really the discussion or the point that I want to make. The point I want to make is that this, to me, is an analogy or a metaphor to what's going on globally. Now, the discussion about deep adaptation, which, if you're not familiar with that, is the idea that it's already too late to do anything about climate change and that social collapse is inevitable. And I think the fact or the comparison between these two issues of race issues and climate issues indicates that there really is no deep concern sufficient to arrest the obvious problems. The fact that we have known for decades about climate change, known what the consequences will be, and done nothing, and the result is what we're going through today, is strong confirmation, I believe, that there's not going to be any improvement and the social collapse is inevitable. And it's not just the Blacks and minorities and immigrants who are going to be mistreated, but now we see that groups outside of that minority group are going to be affected and mistreated as well. That's my reading of the way things have played out.
Well, hey, listen, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Tracy, you want to have a go at that?
Absolutely. I mean, I the whole idea that we can't turn back is it's daunting, right? We've watched the clock. We've ran the clock out on climate change for sure. We've ran the clock out on racism for sure. And what is so interesting is that there are the deniers, right? Denial is such a deep and entrenched response to being faced with a reality that you don't want to face. And I think for sure there is, in the first commentary, right, there's a non-systemic patch to these problems. And the non-systemic patch is, well, let's sing, you know, the Black National Anthem at every football game. Let's write Black Lives Matter on the back of our jerseys, or let's stop chokeholds, right? We're going to say no more chokeholds for police, right? And none of these are systemic responses to systemic racism, and we've done nothing systemic on the front of climate change, because there are people who benefit from the current situation. They will, you know, suck the earth dry, for lack of a better word, because they're benefiting from it. And I don't like to believe that there is no going back, but I feel like we're at the precipice where if we don't change course, like right now, and I feel like this is what's driving kind of the revolutionary act of regular everyday people. If we don't change course right now, we do get on that path of the inevitable. And that is so scary. It should frighten everybody, not from a fear-mongering space, but a space of what is your impetus to act? What are you going to do about it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That is spot on. And there's another aspect to this, too, and that is the rise of climate change and the dissociative effects of climate change and the rise of incipient fascism, these are mutually reinforcing phenomena. As the social compact begins to break down, as the world becomes less and less habitable, then the probability of a real fascist takeover in the United States becomes more and more likely. It's really hard to separate those two at a certain point. I want to circle back for a minute and pick up something you said a little earlier, and that is that you mentioned people like the Proud Boys and like Patriot Prayer enjoy a heightened level of protection and safety from law enforcement than do Antifa and other members of the left who show up to confront them. I think that's absolutely right, and I think that plays right into the collusion that we talked about at the start of the show between that Clackamas County Sheriff's deputy and that group of private citizens he was talking with. And this has played out recently in a very real way. Back at the end of August, there was a shooting death at a demonstration in Portland. This was a face-off between right-wing elements and left-wing elements here in Portland. And a man was shot. Aaron Danielson, a supporter of Patriot Prayer, was shot and killed by a left-wing demonstrator there who was affiliated at least loosely with the anti-fascist movement. That the shooter fled the scene. He's a guy by the name of Michael Forrest Reinold. I might be pronouncing that incorrectly. He fled the scene. He went to Washington State. He then gave an interview with Vice News. The way this all played out was highly unusual, but this is what happened. He gave an interview with Vice News in which he essentially confessed to the killing of Mr. Danielson in Portland. He claimed it was an act of self-defense. He claimed that Danielson himself was armed and was carrying a pistol, which has been corroborated by law enforcement. And he also claimed that the associates of Mr. Danielson were had knives or shivs or something and were preparing to stab Mr. Reinold and his friend. And Mr. Reinold described it as a self-defense situation. Either he acted or he and his friends were going to get stabbed or shot or worse. The very next day, Mr. Reinold was shot dead in Lacey, Washington, by members of the U.S. Marshals Service. The reporting on exactly how this went down is conflicted, but the preponderance, in fact, the large preponderance of reporting suggests that he was shot and killed without warning. That essentially what happened in Lacey, Washington, instead of due process of law, was a summary execution carried out by federal marshals, presumably at the direction of the Attorney General of the United States. So I want that to sink in for a minute here. By no means am I condoning the shooting of someone at a peaceful demonstration. That is not, nor will it ever be, acceptable or defensible in any way. But I do defend the right of citizens to trial and to due process of law. It is not okay for the federal government to summarily execute someone for a crime that at that point was still alleged, not having been proven in a court of law. And I think this is a deadly extension, Tracy, of the phenomenon you described of right-wing protesters enjoying a greater degree of protection and safety from law enforcement than the left. In fact, if you transgress and you're affiliated with the left, you may end up shot dead without a trial.
I mean, it's been happening to black men for a long time. How about that?
Indeed. Well, you're absolutely right. Yes.
So when we think about extrajudicial killing, murder, basically, our president was on TV just a couple days ago touting that, saying that if there are demonstrations after the election, regardless of what happens, that he will be the president still, and he will put them down immediately. And basically, he's speaking in violence, and there is no, you know, kind of gray area there. He's literally saying, if there is something that happens, you know, that there are people who are upset that he steals another election, that he plans to take care of them in the same way that this person we're talking about was taken care of, right? And literally not taken care of, but executed. And so this is not new. This has been happening for centuries, unfortunately, that certain people have due process and other people don't. And yep. I think it was an eye for an eye kind of thing, like, you killed our guy, we're killing yours. But you can see that there's that law enforcement adjacent experience for people mm-hmm. who are mm-hmm. far on the right wing. And it's been exposed in multiple ways. It's been exposed within the Portland Police Bureau. It's now being exposed in the Clackamas, you know, County Sheriff's Department. And we will continue to see these kind of, you know, fact patterns emerge where there is a deep and clear connection between these two operations. And it's historical, though. If you think about the emergence of the modern-day police forces, it came from, you know, vigilante Old West, whether that was the Texas Rangers and what precluded that. And what precluded that was slave patrol, right?
Right.
So a mechanism of social control, reinforcing, you know, societal norms, and putting people basically in their place. And for the people who got out of line or who didn't adhere to, you know, the principles of social control, there was a way to do away with those people as nuisances. They were executed and said, oh, well, it was self-defense on part of the police or the vigilante. And so we're just seeing these patterns play out in today's world, but they're not new or necessarily very different.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. And the origins of law enforcement, as we understand it in this country, created a paradigm in which law enforcement was understood by members of the majority population, by which I mean white people. Law enforcement was understood as a means to insulate their communities from the lawlessness of the darker races. This was both implicit and explicit. And we can see the evidence is around us every single day that that paradigm persists. And many, many white people either don't think about it enough to really care, or when they do think about it, they're willing to trade what they perceive as the safety of their communities for excessive violence on the bodies of people of color. They're willing to make that trade. And that paradigm has described law enforcement from the very beginning in this country. Now, it's not a complete description. I feel like we always have to add this caveat. Well, not every cop. Not every cop. But this is a part of law enforcement culture. It is real, it exists, it is quantifiable, and we see the evidence around us every single day.
Absolutely.
Let's go back to the phones. Molly, you're next.
Yes, am I on the air? It's hard to tell sometimes in this day. Yes, I would like to say, first of all, that I am sorry, I got distracted. I was looking for something that I wanted to quote, but I am not a proud boy, but I'm a proud woman, proud supporter of KABU, and I have been for as long as I can remember.
Well, thank you.
And I wanted to state that first, and I also wanted to state back that I go way back, and, you know, all this, the Black Lives Matter, it's so important, but I just think back to where we got to when black was beautiful, and so I get so frustrated about all this, but I also felt, you know, since I'm using the power of words, which are powerful, that I felt a little blacklisted. I had so much trouble getting through here. And, you know, you get a little paranoid with the smoke seeping through the cracks in our walls, just like the, I thought, and I'm bringing up the elephant in the room here, but is Joe, like, in a prison cell, like in Russia or something? Like, what's happening in our world, in our democracy now, where we get a chance to speak? And one of the great things about, and I've contributed for KABU and this show, which I notice you still call the Joe and Abe Show, because it's such an exciting show to listen to, be able to partake in, And I'm noticing you're still calling the Joan Abe, and I think Tracy's doing a fantastic job. And I was looking for a quote I had about the power of three, as opposed to one is just a static place, two, dynamic back and forth, but three is a very interesting, and I've always appreciated that with my own friends in conversation. To have three people always makes it so much more interesting. And I want to note, and the reason I had the paranoia, which with all the smoke seeping in, as I said, thought about Joe, is the fact that Joe hasn't come on yet, and I'm not the only one out here listening, hoping that maybe this week Joe would be back on, and maybe Tracy too, and we could get on with having this wonderful show, which definitely has always included Joe. And I don't know how many listeners you may lose without Joe, but he's sorely missed, let me just say, and I speak for very many people. And you know, I know you and you're probably hopefully still friends, Abe. I know I'm going on, not letting you have a chance to speak, but if maybe you could ask Joe to come on, or get Joe just back on, and you and Tracy and Joe can at least go on till the election, because we all need each other right now, and we need Joe, and I'm said my piece.
Hey, well, thank you for the call. Joe's no longer with the program, and I'm not going to discuss the details surrounding his departure. And that's really all I'm willing to say about that. Okay, let's go to Barry. Good morning.
Yes, I'm wondering what happened with Joe. And he isn't on. You said something about a recording that he had made, and you never played it.
No. The door has been left open for Joe to make a statement to our listeners. But that's his decision. That ball is in his court. And I really don't have anything more to say about Joe. Do you have a question about the topic today?
Yes. Well, would he be able to make some statement as to why?
I don't know.
Pardon me?
I don't know. I don't know what his plans are in that regard.
I would just want to know for sure what happened. Okay?
Okay. Thank you very much for the call. There's something, Tracy, that we neglected to mention at the start of our show, and that is, of course, that we are in the midst of KABU's summer membership drive, and we need your support to keep this station on the air. We need it now more than ever at this critical juncture in our community's history and in our nation's history. If you want to support the station, you can do it. It's super easy. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button. That's all there is to it. So as we wind things up, Tracy, what's at the front of your mind as you look forward towards the election in November? What do you fear may come to pass?
You know, I think it's really hard being an Oregonian where, you know, we have, you know, a pretty blue state. It doesn't feel like my vote here is going to matter as much, but it's like, what do we do about those other places where free and fair elections are not really a thing just yet, where we know voter suppression is afoot? And I just received in the mail from the U.S. Postal Service a postcard that is disinformation about how to vote in this next election. And I'm wondering how many people will be impacted by that. As we've seen the United States Postal Service be really weaponized as a way to continue voter suppression and voter, invalidation. And so, I feel pretty comfortable that, you know, Oregon is not going to make a mistake and go for Trump. That way we'll have some different outcomes. And Washington will too, and California will too, but I don't know about the rest of the country. And I know I'm just recently looking at an Oregonian article about people's impression of Black Lives Matters and protests kind of souring over time. If those, the way in which the media has portrayed these events, the way in which the media kind of continues to divide us, will lead to an outcome that we all cannot really afford. right, our lives really depend on this next election. And so I feel a little handcuffed that my own actions will not be, you know, a ripple in the pond. But I'm also very hopeful. I'm an optimist at the core of my being. And so I'm just hoping that it will come out in the right direction so that we can stave off a full-on fascist takeover of our democracy.
It's a lovely 18th century electoral system we have, isn't it? Indeed. Well, I want to thank everyone who called to take part in today's conversation. I know that there's a lot to deal with right now. There's so many overlapping crises, so many overlapping sources of stress. So I want to encourage you all to keep your heads up. This too shall pass. And in the meantime, take the time you need for self-care. Look after yourselves. Look after your loved ones. This isn't over yet. And hopefully we'll all get across the finish line more or less in one piece. Tracy, thank you. It's been wonderful having you on the show today. Thanks again to all of our callers, to engineer Sonia. And this has been the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program. And we will be back at you next week.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements.